So, Sage and Merlin,
Eastshire said 3 hours later,
about that message?
Of course, Your Grace. Eastshire's orderly had overseen the servants who had removed the dishes, then poured the wine, set the decanter on the table at Eastshire's elbow, and withdrawn from the private dining room adjacent to the Duke's quarters, here in the Michaelburg Citadel. It had been an excellent dinner, Merlin thought appreciatively, and the wine was quite good too. Fusion-powered Pikas didn't require nourishment, although his internal arrangements were designed to scavenge the material he needed to produce his naturally growing hair and beard from the food he ingested. Most of that food simply had to be disposed of later. But Pikas had been designed to allow their owners to do anything they could have done in their own biological bodies. Merlin's taste buds were fully functional, although any Safeholdian healer would have gone off in gibbering madness if Merlin had tried to explain to him exactly how they functioned. He'd enjoyed the meal, and aside from a certain degree of tunnel vision, resulting from that single blind spot where commoners were concerned, Eastshire was an incisive observer with a trenchant wit. The table conversation had been just as enjoyable as the meal, and Merlin hoped that wasn't going to change.
It'll be interesting to see whether or not he goes ballistic, the Sajan thought.
Caleb and Charlian had a side bet going, and he suspected the two of them were watching through one of the snarks to see which of them had been right.
For that matter, Narman's probably looking in too, he reflected.
Eastshire was looking at him across the table, he realized, and there was more than a hint of impatience in the Duke's steady regard.
Stop dithering, Merlin, he told himself firmly, and cleared his throat. I'm sure you're aware, Your Grace, he began, that there have to have been some concerns about conflicting loyalties in the Army's officer corps.
You mean I'm aware their majesties have to have wondered how many of the rest of their officers are going to go the way Halbrook Hollow went,
Eastshire said flatly. Merlin's eyebrows rose involuntarily at the bluntness of the Duke's comment, and Eastshire chuckled a bit harshly.
You've always been the soul of courtesy, Sajan Merlin, he said, but only an idiot, which I assure you I'm not, could have failed to realize that one reason you've paid so many visits to Michaelburg on their majesty's behalf was to look into that very concern. And frankly, I've assumed from the beginning that you had to be looking more closely at me than at anyone else, given that Bertram was married to my sister, and how long he and I were friends, even before that. Not to mention the fact that I inherited my present post directly from him. I've also assumed, however, since I haven't been removed from that post, and since their majesties have always treated me with courtesy and frankness, that your reports to them must have been at least generally favorable.
Merlin looked at him silently for a moment or two, then shrugged.
I hope I wasn't too obvious about it, Your Grace, he said a bit wryly, and Eastshire gave another, slightly less harsh chuckle.
As a matter of fact, when I said you were the soul of courtesy, I meant it. And to be honest, I'd have been disappointed if Charlian and Caleb hadn't had reservations.
It was his turn to shrug.
I've watched Her Majesty in particular since she was 12, Sajan Merlin. She didn't survive in Queen Isabel's shadow by being stupid. She didn't do it by being so clumsy as to rub people's noses in the fact that she had to regard them as untrustworthy until they proved otherwise either, though. I'd say you've served her quite admirably in both those regards.
Thank you. Merlin bobbed a half bow across the table, then smiled. And yes, Your Grace, the verdict in your case was entirely favorable. And while it may not really be my place to add this, my impression is that Her Majesty was as pleased by that, on a personal level, as she was in her official persona. I don't believe she regards or values you solely as a vassal or even as the commander of her army.
Good.
Eastshire's expression softened.
I couldn't blame her for worrying.
but I won't pretend it didn't bother me anyway.
Sadness touched his brown eyes.
I suppose a lot of that was because of the reason she had to worry in the first place.
He shook his head.
I wondered how Bertram was going to deal with that conflict of loyalties. I knew it was going to be hard for him, but...
The Duke broke off, shaking his head again, harder. There was something about the motion, almost like a prize fighter, trying to shake off the effects of a powerful left jab, and his eyes were distant, looking at something only he could see. Then he gave his shoulders a small twitch, took a sip of wine, and turned back to Merlin with a brisker air.
And now, about that message?
Well, discarding all the courteous euphemisms and circumlocutions I was going to employ, Your Grace, the short version is that their Majesties and Prince Narmon have determined that, unlike you, one of the officers on your staff most definitely does have divided loyalties. In fact, the evidence available to Prince Narmon suggests the officer in question is actively involved in treason.
And every word I just said is completely true, he reflected, even if Charlian and Caleb and Narmon have made that determination on the basis of information I provided.
Eastshire snapped upright in his chair, and his expression hardened abruptly. The adjective that came to mind, Merlin decided, was thunderous.
"Who is the bastard?"
the Duke demanded, and his tone was even harsher than his expression.
"I'll roast his fucking balls over a low fire, and that'll be the gentlest thing that happens to him."
"Well, so far it looks like Caleb's going to win the bet," Merlin thought dryly.
"Please, Your Grace," Merlin raised both hands and made gentle, patting, go-slow motions.
"I warned you this is going to be complicated. I doubt their Majesties would have any problem with your doing exactly that, eventually."
"Eventually?"
Eastshire's expression transformed into one of disbelief.
"Langhorne Sagen, you just said he's on my own staff. Do you realize what sort of information that means he has access to? How much damage he can do?"
"That's the reason, or one of the reasons at least, their Majesties sent me to discuss this with you."
Merlin grimaced.
"To be perfectly frank, Your Grace, I think there was some concern about how well you'd be able to dissemble if you knew the officer in question was a traitor. I hesitate to say this, but you're not exactly known for personal subtlety."
For a heartbeat, it looked as if Eastshire literally couldn't believe what he'd just heard. Merlin looked back calmly, wondering whether or not the Duke was going to explode. But then, instead, Eastshire astounded him with a sharp barking laugh.
"Not known for subtlety, is it?"
The Duke jabbed an index finger at his dinner guest.
"Subtlety!"
"Only on a personal basis, Your Grace," Merlin said earnestly. "When it comes to politics, Her Majesty believes you can lie, deceive, and dissemble with the best."
Eastshire laughed again, then shook his head and gave Merlin a moderately severe glare.
"All right, Sagen, point taken. But..."
His expression sobered once more, and he leaned slightly forward.
"I stand by my original observation. Anyone on my staff knows entirely too much about the new weapons, the new tactics, our strategic thinking and planning, our troop strengths."
He shook his head again.
"If someone's passing on that kind of information, even just to our own temple loyalists, it's damned well ending up in the temple."
"Agreed."
Merlin nodded, and his own expression was much more serious than it had been.
"On the other hand, I think part of the decision-making process was that, with the Church's semaphore systems in the Empire now in our hands and not the Group of Fours, any information from Chisholm will take months getting to Zion. By the time it does, it's going to be thoroughly obsolete and out of date. It's not going to have any immediate tactical value to them, at any rate."
But it could have quite a lot of value in terms of doctrine and how the new weapons work,
Eastchair countered.
The longer it takes them to start figuring out that kind of crap, the better I'll like it.
Your Grace, much as I might wish it were otherwise, not all the people serving Clinton and Maguire are idiots, and the Inquisition's intelligence services have always been among the best in the world. It could hardly be any other way, given the Inquisition's responsibilities, now could it? Merlin held Eastchair's eyes until the Duke nodded slightly, then shrugged.
That being the case, I think we have to assume more information than we'd like, especially about the new weapons, is going to find its way into the Temple's hands no matter what we do. For that matter, by this time, someone's almost certainly managed to divert actual examples of them into Temple loyalist hands. I'd be extremely surprised if they don't already have at least a few of our rifles in Zion by now, for example. And I think we have to take it as a given that anything Coruscant had figured out before our actual invasion had been transmitted to the Temple as well. So even though our staff officer traitor may be able to do some damage in that regard, their majesties are of the opinion that the damage he can do is outweighed by other considerations.
Other considerations,
Eastchair repeated, his eyes narrowing.
Should I assume from that, Sajan Merlin, that their majesties, oh, and let's not forget Prince Narmon, have concocted some strategy to use this traitorous bastard?
Oh, I think you can take that as a given, Your Grace. Merlin smiled nastily. In fact, if you can restrain your impulse, completely natural and fully understandable though it is, to cut off his testicles and roast them, I think we may be able to use one relatively minor traitorous bastard to set a little trap for a very major traitorous bastard.
Did I say something to make you think I intended to cut them off before I fried them?
Eastchair inquired acidly, and despite the fact that Nemue Alban had been born a woman, Merlin winced slightly as he realized the Duke meant it. My error, Your Grace, he apologized. Nonetheless, my point stands.
I see.
Eastchair settled back in his chair again, right hand toying with the stem of his wine glass, while the fingers of his left hand drummed slowly, rhythmically, on the linen tablecloth.
It occurs to me, he said finally, given what you've just said about my subtlety or lack thereof, that their majesties wouldn't have sent you to tell me about this unless they need me to make this strategy of theirs work. I mean, they would have preferred not to tell me a thing about it and give me the opportunity, in my own inimitably unsubtle fashion, to warn him he's under suspicion.
The Duke showed his teeth briefly.
I imagine, for example, that squeezing his head like a pimple the next time I saw him might be just a tiny giveaway.
Indeed. Merlin decided not to respond directly to that last comment, and contented himself with another nod, then went on a bit more briskly. Actually, there are two things they need you to do. First, they wanted to be certain you knew about him and about their plans before you became aware of his activities on your own. They were pretty sure that if that happened, you'd arrest him immediately, then inform them of what you'd discovered. He paused briefly, and Eastchair nodded in understanding. Secondly, Merlin continued, they want you to actually help his treason along a little bit. The Duke's facial muscles tightened ever so slightly, and he looked for a moment as if he were going to protest. He didn't, though.
Thinking that if someone else notices you helping his treason along, they're likely to assume you're a traitor too, aren't you, Your Grace? He thought. Well, I don't blame you. And frankly, the fact that the thought occurred to you and you didn't automatically object only makes me think still better of you.
Who is this fellow?
Eastchair asked instead. Earl Swale, Your Grace, Merlin replied quietly. The Duke grimaced. There was pain in that expression, not surprisingly, given how long the Therys and Roskale families had known one another. but there was less surprise than there might have been.
I wondered about that, or perhaps I should say I was afraid of that.
Eastshare's voice was even quieter than Merlin's, and he shook his head sadly.
He's shut up about it lately, especially since that business at St. Agatha's, but his initial reaction to the marriage proposal was unhappy.
The Duke shook his head again.
I think he blamed the Emperor for luring the Queen into apostasy. If he did, it was stupid of him. I can't remember the last time, or for that matter the first time, anyone managed to lure Charlian into anything she didn't want to do all along. Still, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what drew him into active treason, assuming Prince Narman's evidence is valid.
If it turns out their Majesty's suspicions are baseless, then what they have in mind will do no harm, Your Grace. If their suspicions are valid, however, we may accomplish several very useful things.
All right, Sajan Merlin, Eastshear said with a trace of sorrow. I'll accept, tentatively at least, that he's gone rogue. And I'll not only keep my hands off him, but pretend he's still one of my trusted officers and friends. Now, please be good enough to tell me exactly what it is their Majesties have in mind.
Of course, Your Grace. The main thing is...
9. St. Catherine's Church, Candlemaker Street, and a warehouse, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant, and Captain Merlin Athrawas's room, Imperial Army Barracks, Michaelburg, Duchy of Eastshire, Kingdom of Chisholm.
So, there you are.
Tymon Hoskins twitched, then looked up with a visibly guilty expression. Delores Hoskins stood at the top of the narrow stair in her nightgown, looking down at him, arms folded while the toes of one bare foot tapped ever so gently on the landing. She was a tallish, slender woman, 8 years younger than her husband, with auburn hair just starting to go gray and blue-green eyes. At the moment, those eyes were sternly narrowed, Hoskins noted. He considered, briefly, prevaricating, but after the next best thing to 30 years of marriage, that would have been an exercise in futility. So, since he'd been caught anyway, he decided his best course was to manfully own up to his misdeeds.
I was discussing this 5-day sermon with Jaife Leytir.
Swilling down beer with Jaife Leytir until all hours, don't you mean? She demanded.
We might perhaps have partaken of a tankard or two, strictly as a source of desperately needed sustenance while we contemplated weighty matters of theology, he replied with immense dignity, and the corners of her mouth twitched. It was barely a shadow of the broad grin he would normally have seen at this point in their familiar, well-worn exchange, yet his heart eased, a little at least, when he saw it. Father Jaife Leytir was the senior priest at the Church of the Holy Archangels Triumphant in Grey Lizard Square, two parishes over from Hoskins' own St. Catherine's, and the two of them had been friends for many years. Despite the fact that Hoskins was a bedardist while Leytir was a posquelet, they saw eye to eye on quite a few issues, including several they'd both been forbidden to speak about. Which was why Delore's eyes were worried, and she found it so difficult to smile.
Desperately needed sustenance, is it? She cocked her head, deliberately seeking the reassurance of comforting routine. Should I assume from the fact that you were forced to resort to liquid sustenance that Mistress Donzai was somehow incapable of providing you and your crony with sandwiches?
Lisbeth Donzai had been the housekeeper in charge of Holy Archangel's Triumphant's rectory even longer than Esmelda Dobbins had held the same post at St. Catherine's. Over the years, she'd become adroit at the care and feeding of Father Jaife, and probably almost as good at bullying him into taking care of himself, as Delores and Mistress Dobbins were at chivying Hoskins into doing the same thing.
As a matter of fact, we did supplement our liquid intake with a wyvern breast sandwich or two, Hoskins acknowledged.
Good. In that case, perhaps the two of you stayed sober enough to actually get something worthwhile done, his wife observed. And he chuckled as he climbed the stairs and folded her into his arms.
She was stiff for just a moment, and he felt another spasm of sorrow as he recognized the tension which had tightened her muscles. Then she relaxed, leaning her cheek against his chest and putting her arms around him in a tight hug, whose strength said all the things she hadn't allowed herself to voice. He bent over her, tucking the top of her head under his chin and raising his right hand to stroke her hair ever so gently. After so long together, he knew there was no need for him to apologize or explain, that she knew exactly what had impelled him, driven him to the stance he'd taken. She didn't like it. In fact, she'd argued with him when he'd first told her he intended to acknowledge Archbishop Claremont's and Bishop Kaisi's authority. Not because she'd had any great love for Mancheer's previous bishop or for Bishop Executor Thomas, because she hadn't. But she had been afraid of where Hoskins' inner anger at the church's corruption was likely to take him. And she'd been more than a little afraid his decision would find him branded a traitor to Coruscant as well as to Mother Church. Yet, despite her concerns, despite her very real fear for the husband she loved, she'd argued neither long nor hard. Perhaps that had been because she'd recognized argument was futile. That, in the end, he was going to do what faith and conscience demanded of him, no matter what. He thought it was more than that, though. Her concern was for his safety, not the product of any rejection of his beliefs, for she shared those beliefs. She might be less passionate than he, more willing to work by increments, rather than confront the whole mass of the church's corruption head on, but she recognized that corruption. She knew as well as he did what a travesty of God's original intent the church had become. Which didn't make her one bit happier at the thought that he and Jaife Letir, whose reformist zeal was every bit as deep as his own, had been coordinating their sermons for the coming Wednesday.
"I'm sorry, love," he murmured into her ear now, and her embrace tightened farther. "I don't mean to distress you, but..."
"But you're a stubborn, determined, passionate, pig-headed lunatic of a bedardist," she interrupted, never lifting her cheek from his chest, and produced a laugh that was only slightly wavery around the edges. She stayed where she was for another moment or two, then leaned back just far enough to rise on her toes and kiss his bearded cheek. "I can't pretend I didn't know that when you proposed. Although, now that I think about it, the pig-headedness, at least, has probably gotten a bit more pronounced over the last few decades."
"I imagine it has," he said softly, his lively brown eyes warm with affectionate gratitude.
"Oh, I'm sure it has." She looked back at him, gave him one last affectionate squeeze, and then let him go. "I assume that despite your present drink-befuddled condition, you'll want to transcribe your sermon notes before you come to bed?"
"I'm afraid so," he agreed.
"Well, I can't say I'm surprised, and Esmelda left a plate of ham sandwiches in your study. Just in case hunger should threaten to overcome you again, you understand."
"And a tankard of beer to go with it?" he asked hopefully, eyes laughing at her.
"And a pitcher of cold water to go with it," she responded severely. She and I were of the opinion that you'd probably have had sufficient beer while contemplating weighty matters of theology with Jaife.
"Alas, you were probably right," he told her, reaching out to touch her cheek lightly.
"Then go, go," she made shooing motions with both hands. "And don't stay up all night," she admonished, as she started down the stairs once more.
The better part of 2 hours later, Hoskins leaned back in his chair and rubbed his eyes lightly. Those eyes were no longer as young as they'd once been, and although Esmelda Dobbins kept the lamp's reflectors brightly polished,
Their illumination was a poor substitute for daylight.
"And it's not exactly as if you had the best handwriting in the world either, Timon," he reminded himself.
Which was true enough. Fortunately, he was just about finished. He wanted to let the thoughts roll around in his brain for another day or so before he put it into final form, and there were a couple of scriptural passages he needed to consider inserting. As a general rule, he tried to avoid weighting his sermons with too much scripture, yet his thoughts chopped off abruptly as the heavy cloth bag descended over his head from behind. Total shock immobilized him for a single heartbeat, which was just long enough for whoever had managed to creep so silently into the study behind him that he'd never heard a thing to jerk the throat of the bag tight around his neck. He started to reach up and back, arching to fling himself out of the chair, then stopped as cold, sharp steel touched his throat just below the edge of the bag.
"Make one sound," a voice hissed in his ear, "and I cut your fucking throat right now."
He froze, heart racing, and someone laughed quietly. It was an ugly, hungry sound. "Better," the voice said, and he knew now that there were at least two of them, because it didn't belong to the man who'd laughed.
"Now you're coming with us," the voice continued.
"No."
Hoskins was surprised by how calmly, how firmly, the word came out.
"Go ahead and cut, if that's what you're here to do," he continued.
"If that's what you want," the voice said. "Of course, if that is what you want, we'll have to cut the throat of that bitch upstairs too, won't we?"
Hoskins' heart froze.
"Didn't think about that, did you?" the voice sneered. "Not so cocky now, are you, you fucking traitor?"
"I've been many things in my life," Hoskins replied as levelly as he could, with a knife at his throat and terror for his wife in his heart. "But never a traitor."
"I see you're a liar, too," the voice grated. "Now there's a surprise. But either way, you're coming with us, now."
The knife pressed harder.
"Aren't you?"
Hoskins was silent for a moment, and then he made himself nod. Timon Hoskins had no idea how long he'd sat bound to the chair. He had only the vaguest notion of where he might be. They'd brought him here in a freighter's cart, hidden under its canvas cover, with the blinding bag still over his head. He didn't think they'd hauled him around long enough to actually leave the city, although he couldn't be certain of that. He'd thought about crying out, despite the fact that it was unlikely anyone would have been wandering about the capital's streets to hear him at such a late hour. But his captors had gagged him after they'd bound him, and the voice with the knife had squatted beside his head the entire time. From the sound the cart's wheels had made when they finally reached their destination, and the noise of what had sounded like heavy sliding doors, he suspected he was in a warehouse somewhere. There were enough of those still standing idle and empty in the wake of the Carizian siege, and this one had seemed quite large. Large enough, he felt confident, that no one outside its walls was likely to hear anything that went on inside it. He'd spent his time silently reciting scripture. The familiar passages helped. Yet not even they could dissolve the cold, frozen lump in his belly. The nature of his abduction and the threat against Delors told him entirely too much about the men behind it, and he was only mortal. There were limits to the amount of fear even the strongest faith could nullify. No doubt they were leaving him here, abandoned and alone, to let that fear work upon him. He wished he could say the strategy wasn't working. But a door opened suddenly behind him. He stiffened, muscles tensing, then blinked painfully against the light as the bag was snatched off of his head at last. The light, he realized a moment later, wasn't actually as bright as it had seemed to his darkness-accustomed eyes. It took them a few seconds to adjust, and then his gaze focused on the wiry, brown-haired, brown-eyed man, standing facing him with his forearms folded across his chest. The man was probably at least 20 years younger than Hoskins, with a severely scarred cheek. It looked like an old burn, and even now Hoskins felt a twinge of sympathy for whatever sort of injury could have produced that deep and disfiguring a scar.
"So," the scar-faced man said, and Hoskins' sympathy evaporated abruptly as he recognized the voice from his study. "Have you been enjoying a quiet little meditation, Father?"
His sneer turned the clerical title into an obscenity, and Hoskins felt his own eyes hardening in response.
"As a matter of fact," he forced himself to say calmly, "I have. You might try it someday yourself, my son."
"I'm not your son, you fucking traitor," the scar-faced man snarled.
His arms unfolded abruptly, his right hand falling to the hilt of the ugly-looking knife sheathed at his belt.
"Perhaps not," Hoskins said. "But any man is a son of Mother Church and God, unless he chooses not to be."
"Like you," the scar-faced man hissed.
"I've chosen nothing of the sort."
Hoskins met the other man's ugly, hating eyes as steadily as he could.
"Don't lie to me, you bastard."
The scar-faced man drew a quarter inch of blade out of the sheath.
"I've sat in your fucking church myself. I've heard you spewing filth against Mother Church. I've seen you licking the arse of Shan Wei damned Carizians and those gutless wonders on the Regency Council."
"None are so blind as they who refuse to see," Hoskins quoted quietly.
"Don't you dare quote the writ to me."
The scar-faced man's voice rose sharply, but Hoskins simply shrugged as well as he could, given how tightly bound to the chair he was.
"That's why it was given to us," he replied. "And if you hadn't stopped up your ears and closed your eyes, exactly as Langhorne had in mind when he gave us that passage, you'd know I've never spewed a single word of filth against Mother Church. I've spoken only the truth about her enemies."
The knife hissed out of its scabbard, and the scar-faced man twisted the fingers of his left hand in Hoskins' hair, yanking his head back. Keen-edged steel pressed his arched throat once more, and the other man's lips drew back in an ugly, animal-like snarl.
"You are her enemy,"
he half-whispered, eyes blazing with hatred.
"Every time you open your mouth, you prove it, and you drag others with you into heresy and apostasy and treason."
"For it will come to pass that the wise man will speak wisdom to the fool, and the fool will not recognize it."
Hoskins had no idea how he managed to get the words out as he stared up into that hate-filled glare. It was part of the same passage from the Book of Langhorne he'd already cited, and for an instant he thought his captor was going to slash his throat then and there. In fact, a part of the priest hoped he would. But the scar-faced man made himself stop. He twisted the hair in his left hand hard enough to make Hoskins hiss with anguish, despite all he could do, then threw the captive's head to one side and stepped back.
"I told them you wouldn't have anything worthwhile to say," he said then, calmly, almost caressingly. "They thought you might, but I knew. I've listened to you preach, you worthless son of a bitch. I know exactly what kind of..."
"That's enough, Ron."
Hoskins hadn't heard the door open again behind him, but now he turned his head and saw another man. This one wore the purple habit of the Order of Schuler and a priest's cap with the brown cockade of an underpriest, and Hoskins' stomach muscles clenched as he saw him. The newcomer looked at Hoskins in silence for several seconds, then shook his head.
"Young Ron can be a bit impetuous, and his language is often intemperate, Father Timon," he said. "Nonetheless, he does have a way of cutting to the heart of things. And deep in your own heart, I'm sure, you realize even now that everything he's said is true."
"No, it's not," Hoskins replied,
and there was an odd serenity in his voice now.
You and he can shut your eyes if you choose. God gave you freedom of will. He won't stop you from exercising it, no matter how you may have perverted your own understanding of his truth. But the fact that you choose not to see the sun makes it no less bright.
At least you remember the words of the Holy Writ, I see.
The Schulerite's smile was thin.
It's a pity you've chosen to turn your back on its meaning. I have established his holy church as he has commanded me, and I give it now into your care and the care of your fellows, chosen of God. Govern it well, and know that you are my chosen inheritors and the shepherds of God's flock in the world.
Langhorne gave that charge to the vicarate, not to me, and most assuredly not to you. When you raise your voice in impious attacks on the vicarate, you attack Langhorne and God himself.
I do not, Hoskins said flatly, the words measured and cold. In the very next verse, Langhorne said, "See that you fail not in this charge, for an accounting shall be demanded of you, and every sheep that is lost will weigh in the balance of your stewardship." Vicar Jaspar and his friends should have remembered that, because somehow I doubt God will forget it when their time comes to face him. I am not he to demand that accounting, but I am a priest. I, too, am a shepherd. I, too, must one day give my accounting, and I will lose none of my sheep for a grand inquisitor, so lost to corruption and ambition that he casts entire realms to fire and destruction on a whim.
The Schulerite's eyes glittered, yet he was more disciplined than the scar-faced man. His nostrils might flare, and anger might darken his face, but he made himself draw a deep breath.
Shan Wei can entrap men in many ways, he said coldly, and arrogance of spirit, the sheer vanity that sets your own intellect higher than God's holy word, is one of the most seductive. But Mother Church is always prepared to welcome home even the worst of sinners, if their repentance and contrition are genuine.
Or if the Inquisition tortures them long enough, Hoskins returned grimly.
Sparing the flesh and losing the soul is scarcely the path of godly love, the Schulerite said. And in your own case, Father, you've done enormous damage to Mother Church. We cannot permit that. So we offer you a choice. Renounce your heresy, your lies, your false accusations and vile assault on the very foundations of God's creation in this world, and Mother Church will once again embrace you.
You mean you want me to stand in my pulpit once more and lie?
Hoskins shook his head.
I won't. You and I both know I've spoken nothing but the truth. I won't renounce it at the command of someone who continues to serve the filth and corruption festering at the heart of the temple.
Schuler knows how to deal with Mother Church's enemies,
the Schulerite said ominously, and Hoskins surprised both of them with a short, sharp bark of laughter. It was a sound of contempt, not humor.
Do you think I didn't already realize where you were headed?
He shook his head again, his eyes defiant.
I know what your master in Zion did to Archbishop Erak, and I know the true reason he did it. For myself, I have no love for the Empire of Karis, but the Church of Karis knows God's enemies when it sees them. So do I, and I know who I choose to stand with.
You speak bravely now,
the Schulerite said coldly, softly.
You'll change your tune soon enough when you realize Shan Wei will not stretch forth her hand to save you from God's just wrath.
I may.
Hoskins made no effort to hide the fear both of them knew was coiled at his core like some frozen serpent, yet his voice was steady.
I'm only a man, not an archangel, and the flesh is weak. But whatever may be about to happen to my flesh, I will face God unafraid. I've done only what he commanded all of his priests to do. I'm sure I've made mistakes along the way,
All men do that, even those called to his service. But in this much, at least, I've made no mistake, and you and I both know that's the true reason I'm here. You have to shut me up before I do even more damage to that whoremonger Clinton.
Silence!
The Schulerite lost his temper at last, and his open palm smashed across Hoskins' face. His arm came back the other way, backhanding the bound priest, and Hoskins grunted in anguish as he tasted blood, and more blood erupted from his nostrils. Only the cords binding him to the chair kept him in it. The Schulerite stepped back abruptly, rigid arms straight down at his sides, and Hoskins spat a thick gobbet of blood on the warehouse floor.
So, telling the truth about Clinton is a worse crime than betraying Mother Church, is it?
He asked then, his voice thicker as he was forced to breathe through his mouth.
You profane God's very air with every word you speak,
the Schulerite told him flatly.
We cast you out. We commit you to the outer darkness, to the corner of hell reserved for your dark mistress. We expunge your name from the children of God and strike you forever from the company of redeemed souls.
Hoskins' stomach muscles were a solid lump of curdled lead as he heard the formal words of condemnation. They came as no surprise, not after what had already passed, yet he discovered that actually hearing them carried a terror, a sense of finality, he hadn't anticipated even now. Perhaps, a corner of his mind suggested, that was because he hadn't realized he could feel any more terrified than he'd already felt. Yet there was more than simple fear, more than panic. There was an awareness that the moment had come for him to repay all the joys God had granted him. He watched the scar-faced man slowly, mockingly, drawing his knife once again, and despite his fear, he breathed a silent prayer of thanks. He never doubted that what was about to happen would be worse, far worse, than anything he could truly have imagined. But at least his captors lacked the full array of implements of torture the Book of Schuler prescribed for Mother Church's enemies. Whatever happened to him, he would be spared the full horror the Inquisition had inflicted upon Erek Dinis. And as he watched that knife being drawn, even as a hand jerked his head back once more, and another hand ripped his cassock down around his waist, he prayed that he would find the same courage, the same faith Dinis had found. Merlin Athrawas's eyes snapped open. Nemu Albin had always slept deeply, restfully. She'd never really liked waking up, and the process of getting her brain stirred into full wakefulness had usually taken at least a minute or two. Merlin wasn't like that. For him, the shift between sleeping, as Caleb had demanded that he do each night, and coming totally awake was as abrupt as turning a switch. Which, after all, was exactly what happened. So, when those sapphire eyes opened, he was fully aware of his surroundings, of the hour. Which meant he was also fully aware that his internal clock should not have awakened him for another hour and 12 minutes.
Lieutenant Commander Albin?
Merlin's eyes, faithful to the involuntary reflexes of their human prototype, widened in surprise as the voice spoke silently in his electronic brain.
Owl?
He blurted, so astonished he actually spoke out loud.
Is that you, Owl?
He went on, thus, he realized an instant later, confirming his astonishment, since there was no way he could have failed to recognize the distant AI's voice. At least he'd managed to sub-vocalize this time, though. A not insignificant consideration, given that his guest bedchamber's walls here in Duke Eastshire's Michaelberg headquarters were scarcely anything one could have called soundproof.
Yes, Lieutenant Commander Albin, the computer confirmed.
What is it? Merlin demanded, widened eyes narrowing once more in speculation.
A situation not covered by my instructions has arisen, and I require your direction to resolve it, Lieutenant Commander Alban.
In what way? Merlin's voice was taut. This was the first time the AI had initiated contact with him without specific instructions to do so. As such, it was evidence that the fully realized self-awareness the manual had promised Owl would gradually develop might actually be starting to turn up. But the fact that the computer had awakened him suggested that whatever had impelled him to reveal his developing capabilities wasn't going to come under the heading of good news.
I have just received a routine upload from Snark Remote, Charlie Bravo 7913,
Al replied to his question.
Analysis of its content suggests you would wish it called to your attention.
What kind of content? Merlin asked. The two-letter initial designator for the Snark indicated that it was one of the Coruscantian recon platforms. But although his own memory was as perfect as Owl's these days, he hadn't attempted to remember the full designation on any of them.
The subject Hoskins, Father Timon, has been abducted, Owl said.
What? Merlin sat bolt upright on his bed.
The subject Hoskins, Father Timon, has been abducted, Al repeated,
and developing self-awareness or no, the AI's electronic voice sounded far too calm, disinterested. When? Merlin demanded, swinging his body around to put his feet on the floor and already reaching for his clothes.
He was abducted approximately 5 hours, 19 minutes, and 31 seconds ago, Lieutenant Commander,
Al responded. And you're only telling me about it now? Merlin knew the question was unfair, even as he asked it. The fact that Owl had decided on his own to mention it at all was the next best thing to a miracle, yet even so.
I had no specific instructions to monitor for abductions, Lieutenant Commander, Owl told him calmly. Absent such instructions, my filters did not call the event immediately to my attention. I discovered the situation only as the result of a routine data dump from Charlie Bravo 7913. When I downloaded the data, I immediately contacted you.
Merlin stood, dragging on his breeches and reaching for his tunic. What's Hoskins' current situation? Give me a real time from the Snark.
Of course, Lieutenant Commander.
The AI obeyed the instruction almost instantly, and Merlin Athrawes grunted in shock as the imagery appeared suddenly in his electronic brain. Dear God, a stunned corner of his mind thought numbly. Dear God. He flinched as the Snark's audio sensors faithfully filled his senses with a throat-tearing scream. The bloody horror of the scene hammered in on him, and that same numb, distant corner of his mind knew that if he'd still been a being of flesh and blood, his stomach would have heaved in automatic protest. It froze him, that horror, and he'd seen horror enough for a dozen normal lifetimes by now. He started to order Owl to ready the recon skimmer, but the order died ungiven. He was almost 3,000 miles from Manchir. It would take him 40 minutes to make the flight, even at Mach 5, and another 15 minutes just to get the recon skimmer here and himself aboard it. For that matter, however cautious he might be, there was always the possibility someone might spot the skimmer picking him up. From the hideous damage which had already been inflicted upon the priest, there was no way Hoskins would survive long enough for Merlin to get there. And given the limitations of Safeholdian medicine, his brutal wounds were undoubtedly already mortal. Even if Merlin chose to risk betraying his own demonic capabilities, Timon Hoskins was already a dead man. And, God help me, the sooner he dies, the better, Merlin thought sickly. He sank back down on the bed, sapphire eyes blind, as the sights and sounds ripped through his direct feed from the Snark. He should shut it down, he told himself. There was nothing he could do, not now.
it was too late, and there was no need, no reason, for him to subject himself to the horror of Hoskins' death. But there was a need and a reason. He understood Adderai Dinnis now, better than he ever had before. Understood why she hadn't been able to turn away, refused to witness what the Inquisition had done to her husband. Someone had to know. Someone had to bear witness. And, he told himself grimly, someone had to remember. 10. Priory of St. Justin, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. Adrian Wyman leaned back in his chair and rubbed weary eyes. The messages and reports in front of him were beginning to blur when he tried to read them, and common sense was trying to insist it was time he took himself off to bed. He could still get a couple of hours' sleep before dawn, and Langhorne knew he needed them. There never seemed to be enough hours in a day. That was true for any intendant, even when he operated openly from his office in his archbishop's palace. When he was forced to discharge his duties from hiding, skulking about lest the very secular authorities who were supposed to obey his instructions find him and drag him before an apostate archbishop, the situation could only get worse. Still, he reflected wryly, lowering his hand, there are at least some compensating factors, aren't there? The loss of the semaphore, for example. He snorted. I may have to worry about little things like the damnation of lost souls, being captured and tried for treason, being executed, minor concerns like that. But at least the damned message traffic's been cut way down. His lips twitched at his own feeble attempt at humor, yet there was more than a little truth to it. He was as secure here at St. Justin's as he could have been anywhere in conquered Coruscant, and the truth was that he had little fear of being betrayed to the authorities. That wasn't quite the same thing as no fear, yet it came close. And as the resistance movement spread here in the city, his feelers and information channels continued to spread and grow with it. Yet even though that meant a steadily increasing flow of messages and reports, his lost access to Mother Church's semaphore stations had completely cut him off from events in the rest of the princedom. The handful of dispatches which had reached him here from Bishop Executor Thomas Schiller, smuggled in by trusted couriers, were both short and cryptic. Compared to the smooth, almost instant communication he'd been accustomed to before the Carisian invasion, it was like being rendered deaf and blind. He didn't like it at all, and he especially didn't like it because of how little he knew about what was truly happening outside Manchir. What do you mean, he told himself, is that you worry about it because you don't really trust Bishop Thomas's ability to manage something like this? He's not the sharpest bishop you've ever served, is he? But at least he's determined to do something instead of selling himself to the Carisians, and that's nothing to sneeze at, Adrian. Indeed it wasn't, and to be fair to the deposed Bishop Executor, the contacts he'd apparently established with people like Earl Stormkeep, Earl Deep Hollow, and Baron Larchrose sounded far more promising than Wyman would have anticipated even a few months earlier. Of course, Wyman didn't have any real details on just how Bishop Executor Thomas and his secular allies were coming, or exactly what it was they had in mind, and he'd been excruciatingly careful not to record a single word about them in writing, even here. It didn't really matter, though. His own instructions had come from the Grand Inquisitor himself, issued as a precaution well before the Carisian invasion. Schiller knew, roughly, what those instructions were, and Wyman didn't doubt he was factoring that knowledge into his and his new allies' plans. But whatever they might be up to didn't change Wyman's mission. And Vicar Jaspar was right, the intendant reminded himself yet again. What happens up north is important, maybe even critical, but what happens right here in Manchir is even more important. It's not just the capital, it's the biggest city in the entire princedom, and every other city and town is watching to see what happens here. If this Regency Council and Caleb's Viceroy General can't maintain their control here, then the rest of the princedom's going to be a lot more willing to challenge them. He sat forward once again and reached for the next report. In some ways, he hated writing any of this down, even though he was careful to use code names, known only to him, to identify most of his agents. Written records weren't the safest thing for a conspirator to keep lying around, but without them, he would quickly have lost the ability to keep track of his own operations. It was a matter of striking the best balance he could between security and efficiency. He frowned as he read through the memo which had worked its way to the top of the current pile. It was from Albert Comming, and Adrian Wyman was very much in two minds where Comming was concerned. The man was undoubtedly capable, and he'd proved extraordinarily useful in the past. Unfortunately, one reason he'd proved so useful was that, so far as Wyman could tell, he was completely untrammeled by anything remotely like a scruple. He was, quite simply, a professional assassin. One of the best assassins money could buy, which was the very reason Wyman was ambivalent where he was concerned. Money had bought him Comming services. It was always possible that more money, from another source, would buy Comming's betrayal. And if Albert Comming chose to betray Wyman, the consequences could be catastrophic, since only Comming knew the true identity of the man who'd actually bought and paid for Prince Hector's assassination. Wyman had considered having Comming quietly eliminated. In fact, he'd considered it quite often, but he never had. First, because Comming continued to prove so useful and energetic. Indeed, Wyman was tempted to conclude that Comming cherished a genuine, if somewhat anemic, devotion to Mother Church, although the intendant wouldn't have been prepared to wager any enormous sum on the probability. But the second reason Wyman had so far refrained from arranging the assassin's permanent disappearance was the suspicion that Comming had made his own arrangements to protect himself. It would have been just like the man to tuck away evidence linking Wyman, and by extension the Grand Inquisitor himself, to Hector's murder. Wyman could think of several ways Comming could have arranged things so that any such evidence would find its way into the hands of the occupation if he himself should suffer a mischief. And the intendant was certain Comming was more than sufficiently inventive to have come up with quite a few approaches which hadn't even occurred to him. On the other hand, the fact that he was involved in Hector's assassination cuts both ways, the intendant thought. He can't afford for me to be taken and forced to talk any more than I can afford for him to be taken. So the two of us have an excellent reason to look after one another, don't we? And that, ironically, makes him the most reliable agent I have. And there were certain advantages to relying on a professional. Whatever his other faults, Comming was scarcely going to be betrayed into a fatal misstep by zealotry. And that was more than could be said for some of Wyman's more recently recruited agents. People like Patrick Henry had plenty of enthusiasm, fueled all too often by bitter resentment and hatred. But that same enthusiasm could make them hard to control, which was the main reason Wyman had been so careful to maintain his own anonymity where they were concerned. Henry was one of the few exceptions to the rule, but he also thought the intendant had long since escaped from the city. That was one of the reasons Wyman had put Comming in charge of managing his contacts with Henry's group. It was also one of the reasons he'd decided to trust Comming to decide who to use for the current operation. The intendant had selected the Inquisitor to be entrusted with the mission, but he'd left it to Kamming to choose who would provide what the assassin called the muscle to actually accomplish it. Kamming was far more familiar with the individual agents he'd recruited, with their capabilities and their personalities and motivations, than Wyman was. And Wyman was confident Kamming had used every one of his considerable talents to make sure none of those agents were in a position to lead the authorities back to him, which in turn meant they weren't in a position to lead those same authorities back to Wyman either. "And that's not a minor consideration where this one is concerned," the intendant reflected grimly. The truth was that at least a tiny part of him regretted having ordered Father Timon's kidnapping and execution. Of course, it was only a tiny part, given how utterly the priest's own actions had condemned him. He was scarcely the only member of the clergy to have damned himself by deserting to the Church of Carus. Yet despite his relatively junior ecclesiastic rank, he'd emerged as a clear leader of the reformist traitors here in Coruscant. For himself, Wyman had frequently enjoyed Father Timon's sermons back before the Carisian invasion. The priest had always been an inspired preacher, with a genuine gift for reaching his congregation, for reaching out beyond his own congregation, in fact. Even before the invasion, on the other hand, Wyman had been aware of how Hoskins chafed under Bishop Executor Thomas's discipline. Indeed, his righteous indignation, his burning desire to denounce the corruptors in the temple, had brought him to the Inquisition's attention more than once. He'd found himself in Wyman's office on several occasions, and Wyman doubted Hoskins could have been in any doubt about how Coruscant's intendant felt about his arrogance in daring to judge the actions of the vicarate. Only the fact that he'd discharged all his other priestly duties so well and been wise enough to keep his mouth shut about those private concerns of his had prevented him from being removed from St. Catherine's on at least two occasions. So Wyman had been less than surprised when Hoskins betrayed his vows to Mother Church and gave his allegiance to the Carus-spawned abomination. What had surprised him, however, was the vigor and the eloquence Hoskins had brought to his betrayal, and how effective a traitor he'd proven. He'd become the core of the small but steadily growing clique of churchmen who'd labeled themselves reformists and openly attacked Mother Church at every step. That was bad enough. Even worse, however, was the way in which those reformists were concentrated here in Manchir. Their churches, by and large, ministered to the city's common folk, and that made them dangerous. By legitimizing the Church of Carus among the capital's commoners, they lent legitimacy to the Empire of Carus as well, and the people who were listening to them were the very people Wyman needed to reach if he was going to effectively challenge the occupation's control of the capital. Despite his own bitter fury at Hoskins' actions, Wyman had never believed the priest had betrayed his vows out of personal ambition or greed. No, it was even worse than that, unfortunately. Ambition might have been worked with, and greed might have been appealed to. But the arrogance of self-justified indignation, the sheer effrontery of a man who could set his own faith, his own isolated interpretation of the writ, against the might and the majesty of God's own church, those were something else again. Hoskins didn't give a damn about personal power or wealth or luxury. That was precisely what had made him so effective, so dangerous. Yet however he might dress it up for his congregation's consumption, however skillfully he might twist the writ to make it seem to support his own apostasy, and however the first breach in his own faith might have pierced the defenses of his soul, the man had given himself wholly over into Shan Wei's service now. He had turned his back upon God and the vicarate, and that was why Wyman could scarcely pretend he felt any true regret at having ordered that the traitor be eliminated. and eliminated in a fashion that's going to give the rest of his reformist colleagues reason to reconsider their apostasy. The intendant's jaw tightened. From Cummins' report, we can count on this A-mail to do just that. And he doesn't have any idea at all that I gave the order. For that matter, neither does Father Daishan. Unlike A-mail, Father Daishan Zacho knew exactly who Adrian Wyman was, since he'd worked directly for him for over 6 years. But Zacho had excellent reason to believe Wyman had gotten out of Manchir with Bishop Executor Thomas, since Wyman had specifically told Zacho he was going to do exactly that. So, even in the unlikely event that he and A-mail were both taken by the authorities, Zacho couldn't lead those authorities back to St. Justin's. And of all the inquisitors who had been assigned to Coruscant, Zacho was the least likely to hesitate for a moment over the execution of an apostate priest. "I can't pretend I'm sorry it had to be done," the ex-intendant admitted. "And at least I had the right people in place to see to it." He finished Cummings' report, then found himself yawning hugely as he set it aside. "Enough. I'm going to start making mistakes out of simple fatigue if I keep this up. Time to get some sleep." He yawned again. "Tomorrow's another day. For some of us, at least."
11. Grey Lizard Square, Sir Corin Garvey's townhouse, and Priory of St. Justin, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. A sharp, stabbing gesture brought Sir Corin Garvey's escort to an abrupt, clattering halt on the cobblestones. The anger in Garvey's overly controlled, clenched-fist hand signal was highly unusual. There were men in his escort who'd been with him at the Battle of Harold's Crossing and served with him throughout the Talbor Pass campaign. They'd seen him in the midst of battle, seen him visiting his wounded and comforting his dying, even seen him riding out to surrender his army to Caleb of Carus. They'd seen him angry, seen him worried, seen him grieving, seen him bitterly determined. They'd never seen him like this. The escort reined in its horses more like anxious children, creeping about in the shadow of a father's poorly understood anger, than like the elite picked troops they actually were. They looked around the buildings surrounding Grey Lizard Square, washed with early morning sunlight under a deep blue sky. The air was crisp and cool, warning of heat still to come, yet even more pleasant because its present coolness must be so fleeting. Windows, gay awnings, and the booths and kiosks of the Grey Lizard Market, normally one of the largest and busiest in the city, gleamed in the golden wash of the sun. Those booths and kiosks were empty, though. The people who should have crowded the square, bargaining and chaffering, stood hushed, crowded back around its edges, held there by grim-faced armsmen of the city guard. The stillness and silence of that crowd of people was profound, so absolute that the faint yet clear whistle of wyverns high overhead sounded almost shocking. Garvey dismounted. Yeoman Ulston, his personal armsman, swung down from the saddle beside him. But a chopping hand warned Ulston that even his presence was not welcome this day. He clearly didn't like it, but the dark-haired armsman had served the Garvey family since he was 15, and he'd been assigned to Sir Corin since the general had been a boy. He probably knew Sir Corin's moods better than any other living man, and so he simply accepted the order, took his master's reins, and stood watching as Garvey strode across to the red-stained white sheet.
"I'd not like to be the ones behind this."
Alston's thoughts were harsh with anger of his own.
"I've served the general and his father, man and boy, and I've never seen either of them like this. He'll find whoever did this, and when he does..."
Sir Corin Garvey walked across the cobbles like a man marching into battle,
feeling the stillness around him, acutely aware of the contrast between the cool morning air and the white-hot fury roiling around inside him. He forced his face into a mask of calm, but that mask was a lie, for there was no calm in him.
"Slowly, Corin, slowly," he reminded himself. "Remember all those watching eyes. Remember you're a general, the Regency Council's personal representative, not just a man. Remember."
He reached the red-splotched sheet. A priest knelt beside it, a fair-haired man going to gray, with a full beard. He wore the green habit and caduceus of a brother of the Order of Pasquale, and his priest's cap bore the green cockade of an upper priest. The clergyman looked up as Garvey reached him, and the general saw the tears in the older man's gray eyes, yet the priest's expression was composed, almost serene.
"Father?"
Garvey knew his single-word greeting had come out harsher than he'd intended, and he tried to make his brief bow of greeting less curt. He rather doubted he'd succeeded.
"General?"
the priest returned. He reached out and laid one gentle hand on the sheet.
"I'm sorry you've been called here for this," he said.
"So am I, Father." Garvey inhaled deeply. "Forgive me," he said then. "I'm afraid I'm feeling just a bit angry this morning, but that's a poor excuse for discourtesy. You are..."
"Father Jaife Latir. I'm the rector at Holy Archangels Triumphant."
The priest twitched his head at the stone spire of a church at the nearer end of the square, and his expression tightened.
"I'm reasonably sure they left him here at least partly as a message to me," he said.
Garvey's eyes narrowed for a moment, but then he nodded in understanding as he recognized Latir's name. Sir Charles Doyle, who'd commanded his artillery at the beginning of the Talbor Pass campaign, was now his chief of staff. In addition, Doyle fulfilled the role of Garvey's chief intelligence analyst, and the words of his reports on the growing reformist movement here in Manchir replayed themselves in Garvey's memory.
"Yes, the bastards who did this would want to make sure Latir gets the message," he thought. "I'm afraid you're probably right about that, Father," he said out loud. "On the other hand, I imagine they intended this as a message for all of us."
He bared his teeth for an instant.
"And when we figure out who they are, I'm going to have a little message for them as well."
"Pasquale is an archangel of healing, General," Latir said, looking back down at the sheet-covered form. "Just this once, though, I think he'll forgive me for wishing you every success."
His hand moved on the sheet, stroking it, and he shook his head.
"They didn't have to do this to him."
His voice was so low even Garvey could scarcely hear him.
"They didn't have to do it. They wanted to do it."
"I think you're right about that too, Father," Garvey replied, equally quietly.
Latir looked back up at him, and he shrugged very slightly.
"So far, I've seen very little hatred out of the Church of Caris or your own reformists. I've seen quite a lot coming out of the Temple Loyalists, though."
"As have I," Latir acknowledged. "And it's in my mind that one reason they did this is to ignite that hate among us as well."
He looked back down at the covered body.
"Timon never hated anyone, except perhaps for those corrupt men in Zion, and no one could ever listen to him preach without realizing that. I think that's why he was so effective, and that's why the Loyalists want us to hate as hotly as they do. They want us to lash out at them, to let our own anger fuel the conflict between us, drive the breach still wider and deeper. Let our intemperance justify their own."
"You may be right about that, Father," Garvey said grimly. "And as a son of Mother Church, I hope you and the other priests who have spoken out can resist that hatred, that anger. But I represent the secular authorities, and it's not my job to forgive things like this."
No, I suppose it's not."
Latir looked down for a few more moments, then rose. From the stiffness of his movement, Garvai suspected he'd been kneeling there on those unyielding cobblestones since the body was first discovered, and the general reached out a steadying hand. The older man took it gratefully, then shook himself and nodded once again in the direction of his church.
"I know we had to leave him here until you could examine the scene yourself, General. I understand that. But his wife is in the rectory there with my housekeeper. I offered to stay with her, but she insisted I stay with Timon instead. It was all I could do to talk her into letting me keep him company until you arrived instead of her. I don't think I'd have succeeded if she were in any state to think clearly or argue. Now, though," Laetir shook his head, "please, General, I don't want her to see him, not like this."
"I understand." Garvai met the priest's eyes levelly. "When you go back to her, tell her we have to take the body for our own healers to examine for their reports. Keep her there until we've gone. Tell her it's my request as part of the investigation. I'll have my people do what they can before we release the body to her." His lips tightened. "From the preliminary reports, I don't expect to be able to do a lot. But if you could have clothing for him delivered to my headquarters, I'll have him decently dressed when the healers are finished. Hopefully that should hide the worst of it, at least."
"Thank you, General."
The priest laid one hand on Garvai's forearm and squeezed lightly.
"I'm afraid she already knows from my reaction that it's ugly, but there's a difference between that and actually having to see what those butchers did."
Laetir's voice thickened on the last phrase, and he squeezed Garvai's forearm again. Then he cleared his throat a bit noisily.
"I've already said my farewells," he said softly, "and I've already asked God if Timon can wait a little until the rest of us catch up. So if you'll excuse me, I have a dear friend's widow to comfort."
"Of course, Father," Garvai said gently. He bowed again more deeply, and Laetir sketched the sign of Langhorne's scepter, then turned and walked slowly towards his church and the rectory next door. Garvai watched him go, reading the combined outrage, grief, and determination in the set of the priest's shoulders. There was a courage in Laetir's steady stride as well, one Garvai envied. For himself, he would rather have faced a charge of heavy cavalry, or even a line of Carizian riflemen, than what Laetir was about to face. He wondered for a moment exactly what that said about the difference between physical courage and moral courage. Then he drew another deep breath, went down on one knee, reached for a corner of the sheet, and steeled himself for what he was about to see.